Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus and I welcome you to Sword and Sandal Cinema. Today we'll be exploring three Sword and Sandal films, and we're going to start with Brian Walker and Serpents of the Nile. Greetings and welcome, Brian. How are you?
I am well tonight, Hercules. How are you doing?
I'm doing great and looking forward to learning about a movie that I don't recall very much about at all. So,
well, and you know what? The only reason that I happen to stumble upon it is that Greg routinely combs the guide for Turner Classic Movies and you have to see what's going to be on, and then he will record him. And I was just shuffling through, you know, some of the stuff he had recorded, and one was Serpent of the Nile, and I was thinking that it was a Deborah Padgett film. But when I looked it up on IMDb and you know, I saw that it was Rhonda Fleming, I thought, wow, you know, Rhonda Fleming, you know, was in another, she was in a Sword and Sandal movie called Revolt of the Slaves. And I wanted to see, you know, how, you know, Rhonda Fleming was known for doing a lot of costume epics in the 1950s. And as it turns out, Serpent of the Nile is sort of one of those. With a few caveats there. I'm more of a fan of her film noir, quite honestly. She got her start pretty early in the 1940s in a really great role in a Hitchcock film called Spellbound, which is not one that you hear a lot about when it comes to Hitchcock films. You know, a lot of his 50s and 60s output overshadowed some of the really terrific films that he made in the 1940s, and one of those was Spellbound. Great cast, Ingrid Bergman, Gregory Peck, Leo G. Carroll, and Rhonda Fleming had a sort of a medium-sized role in it, you know, and pretty showy for, you know, a young actress who had, you know, only been in a few films, mostly uncredited. And then she was in another mystery, The Spiral Staircase, which is sometimes confused with her with Hitchcock, but it's not. And that's with Dorothy McGuire and George Brent. And she made another noirish film called Out of the Past with Robert Mitchum. That's really good as well. In the 1950s, she moved into costume epics because, you know, the studios were cranking them out. They were usually Technicolor productions, you know, pretty lavish. Or at least it seemed that way. And the thing that I noticed when I started watching Serpent of the Nile, and there again, I probably haven't seen this since TBS, late 70s, early 80s, was the sets. You know, I'm kind of conditioned when watching Sword and Sandal films to seeing a lot of location shooting, a lot of outdoor. You don't see a lot of matte paintings, you know, in Sword and Sandal films. You usually see, you know, actual countryside, you know, or the shore or something like that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in a lot of B movies, you do just see backdrops. And location shooting is expensive. So backdrops, you know, and the controlled conditions that you have in the studio, It's easier and faster to shoot if you don't have to go out and shoot on location and get everybody to a specific location. It's also cheaper. And that's the thing that struck me about Serpent of the Nile is that it is 95% soundstage. And that makes it really tough, you know, to do any swashbuckling or anything like that. And as a result, there's not much in this. It's mostly talk, quite honestly. There are some things that I really like about the film, and I'll talk about those in just a few minutes. When it comes to watching this one, I mean, don't get your hopes up really high. It was made by Columbia Pictures, and Columbia, they weren't by this time, and they had started out as a Poverty Row studio. By the early 50s, Columbia had some decent output, some decent products. Harry Cohn, who was the president of Columbia, kind of ruled with an iron fist and certainly with an iron wallet, which he didn't like to open very much.
I like that.
Well, I mean, he was notoriously thrifty. On the one hand, that thrift got them out of Poverty Row. So I'm not saying he was necessarily wrong always. But on the other hand, I do think that he only took Columbia as far as he was going to be able to take them. You know, I mean, Columbia certainly went on and you know, produced some huge films, after Cohn passed away in 1958. But I do think, in the 50s, he held them back a little bit by being so conservative. On the other hand, they did survive. Not all studios did. So what do I know? Anyway, the really interesting thing about Serpent of the Nile, to start off with, are the producer and director team. It was produced by Sam Katzman, who did all kinds of B-movies in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. He did things like Don't Knock the Twist. Sam Katzman, prolific, too. He did an Elvis movie called Kissin' Cousins. He did Hot Rods to Hell, which is campy as all get out. It's Gene Crane and Dana Andrews. The Giant Claw, the huge chicken that was menacing Earth. He did Earth versus the Flying Saucers. Sam Katzman was sort of the master at producing B movies and cranking them out. In terms of, I think he had something like 220, 230 producer credits. I mean, that's a lot. How many films do you have in production on any given week? You know, if you're talking about a 30-year career, I mean, that would be hectic. And the other piece of the puzzle is the director, who's William Castle. William Castle, who is known for doing gimmicky horror films in the late 50s and 60s, including The House on Haunted Hill. One of my favorites of Castle's is Homicidal. He did a remake of The Old Dark House with Tom Poston. He was the producer of Rosemary's Baby, interestingly enough, because he owned the property and couldn't get it away. And Roman Polanski and company couldn't get the property away from him. So he was going to produce it, and he did, and it's a terrific film. You know, it doesn't suffer anything, of course, from being a William Castle movie. But before William Castle found his niche as a horror director, he did journeyman films, a lot of B dramas, and he wasn't bad at it or anything. As a matter of fact, there's a lot to recommend Serpent of the Nile. It is competently made. It is in color, and for a Columbia film of this vintage, that's kind of remarkable. On the other hand, color was about the only money that they spent at Columbia on this movie. It's got a good cast. It has Rhonda Fleming is in the role of Cleopatra. And I hate to say it, but she's miscast. For one thing, Rhonda Fleming was known for having these auburn tresses. She had this beautiful auburn hair, big green eyes. She was gorgeous. But in this movie, because she's playing Cleopatra, they put this page wig on her, and she just gets swallowed up by it. And then they've got a really heavy Cleopatra-like makeup on with the sort of the deep blue eyeshadow, and you sort of lose Rhonda Fleming in it. And Rhonda Fleming was a good actress, but she was really known for at some points in her career, she was known for just being decorative. She was beautiful, although she did have talent. She could act. And in this movie, she's largely decorative, but my big issue with that was, okay, she's decorative, but it doesn't look like Rhonda Fleming. So there's kind of, there's a problem there. It's kind of a disconnect. And in her performance, she seems disconnected from the role, too, but she's not alone there. And I have a feeling that had something to do with the speed of production. Also in the cast is Perry Mason. Raymond Burr is Mark Antony. in this. And, you know, I got to say that Raymond Burr, there again, maybe not. Maybe he was cast, you know, against type, but he does his best job with the lines. The lines are a little awkwardly written at times. But Raymond Burr seems to be doing a good job there. The other person in this is William Lundigan. Now, William Lundigan used to be the host of he had been in films like, I think, from the late 30s on. And by the time this film rolled around, which was 1953, this was sort of at the tail end of William Lundigan's career. He went into television in the mid-1950s and hosted some anthology shows on television. And his performance in the film is really wooden, and it's kind of odd because if you watch him in other, if you see a a TV show that he was in, or maybe one of his movies from the 40s, his film, his acting isn't really that wooden. And in this film, it's just he's just saying his lines. I don't know if it's because they had a 3-week shoot on this seemingly lavish costume epic, or I don't know what the issue was. Maybe they resented the really quick production schedule, but one of the things that might have turned the actors off were the sets. Now, the sets were largely from a film that Rita Hayworth had shot right before this one lensed. And this film was produced by Rita Hayworth, and a lot of the sets and a lot of the costumes in this film came from the Rita Hayworth movie. And the Rita Hayworth movie, I should say, was Salome. And it starred Rita Hayworth, Stuart Granger, Charles Laughton, and Judith Anderson. And it was also released by Columbia. So obviously Columbia had access to the sets and the costuming and such. So they were able to borrow pretty heavily from that. But for some reason, they just primarily used curtains wherever they didn't have a backdrop or anything that they could use. It's all curtains. And it just looks ridiculous. Not that the curtains aren't nice, and the copy that Turner Classic Movies has is just sparkling clear. The color is lavish and rich. I mean, I can't say enough good things about the print that Turner has run for Serpent of the Nile. And that's, maybe that's one of the problems with it, because those curtains really pop. There are some scenes, and they're primarily close-ups with Rhonda Fleming's Cleopatra and Raymond Burr's Mark Antony. And I don't know if they were friends or not, but there's just no chemistry between them. Yeah, there's no chemistry among any of the actors, to tell you the truth.
That's horrible.
It is bad, and that doesn't make it less watchable. In fact, that's kind of one of the things to watch the movie for.
Okay.
It's not written terribly well either. the actors are doing what they can with it, because they're shooting this really quickly. I think they had a 15-day shoot, which is about 3 weeks. That's quick, on a film that's going to have really tricky technicolor lighting, where everything has to be lit for 45 minutes to an hour, and adjusting it so everything looks right. And then Rhonda Fleming, photographed well a certain way, so you've got to make sure that she's lit. That's a lot of work, and it doesn't leave a whole lot of time for second and third takes. So, and it was Columbia, where, multiple takes were usually frowned upon. So I think that explains part of the movie. The movie, I got to say, it isn't all bad. It's competently shot. The cinematography is pretty good. There is a little bit of on location stuff. I don't know if it's left over from Salome, and that may be I didn't really check into that aspect of it. But the film's worth a look. I don't know if there are any big Rhonda Fleming fans out there, you know, among the Sword and Sandal folk, although she, like I said, she is in Revolt of the Slaves, which is a 1961 Sword and Sandal film, with her then-husband, who was Lane Jeffries.
So she has connections, and she's part of her mythos, whether it's a gem in the crown of the mythos or not.
There you go. There's some other interesting actors in this film. Jean Byron is one of Rhonda Fleming's handmaidens in it. And if her name doesn't sound all that familiar, she did hours and hours of television in the 50s and 60s. And she might be best known to people as the mom from The Patty Duke Show. You know, Patty Duke's early 60s sitcom where she played identical cousins.
Yes.
Well, she is the American cousin's mother in this. And at the time she was married, at the time that this was produced in 1953, she was married to Michael Ansara. And he has a pretty sizable role in the film. He actually does a good job with the role he has. He gets to be sinister, and that's kind of where his talents lie. Or lay, you know, once upon a time, that is anyway. He's, you know, obviously since passed on. Interestingly, after Jean Byron and Michael Ansara went their separate ways, he married Barbara Eden. From I Dream of, from I Dream of Jeannie. And also interestingly, for Cheesecake fans, Julie Newmar is in the film for a brief amount of time, but it's kind of a showy role too. Years before Shirley Eaton was painted gold in Goldfinger, Julie Newmar, and she's billed as Julie Newmar in this film, but this is her first movie. And she's probably, I don't know, 18 or 19 years old. She's really young. But she is in a gold bikini, and she is painted gold from head to toe and does sort of a dance in it. And like I said, it's a small role, but very showy because the camera is on her for, you know, a solid two and a half minutes. So not bad for, you know, somebody who's still a teenager, right?
Right.
And there are scenes like that that are actually pretty well staged and shot. You know, it's hard to coordinate, you know, at times a fairly sizable cast in this. Most of the scenes involve Raymond Burr, William Lundgren, and Rhonda Fleming, to tell you the truth. It is kind of it's a talky epic. And I guess action costs money. There's a lot of dialogue in this one. But it is wonderfully shot. Whoever was doing the cinematography on it, the camera people and the lighting people, did a fantastic job because all of the actors, you know, look good. Nobody has a sickly gray appearance or anything.
That's good.
Everything's lit pretty well, especially the curtains in the background. Yeah, when I was watching it a few days ago, it just reminded me, and I don't mean to take anything away from this film because I do think that I do recommend watching it because it is kind of a fun movie. But I kind of flashed back to Plan 9 from Outer Space. You know, when they're on the when they're on the spaceship, there's just this curtained wall, and it's that same effect. It's no better than that in some scenes. Now the curtains are probably nicer, and there are some scenes where, you know, Cleopatra is reclining on her chaise and talking to Perry Mason or Raymond Burr, that is, and she has these bright, like, Prince and the Revolution purple curtains in her background, and the curtains themselves are beautiful. I mean, the color is really rich, and it really pops on screen. But on the other hand, you're thinking, you know, why does Cleopatra have purple curtains? So, and you know, they look very And you can see like elements of early 1950s fashion and clothing. Like I said, Julie Newmar is essentially in a bikini, a gold one, but still, it's a fun movie. And there's a bit of camp here and there in the film. But like I said, some of the performances, I really think they could have punched it up a little bit. You know, if you're going to be in something that is obviously this campy, you probably should, punch up your lines, a little more. You could tell that Rhonda Fleming is just paying the rent here. I mean, she seems very detached, from the film itself. And like I said a few minutes ago, I think Raymond Burr gives it his best. I mean, he knows that this is a great film. But interestingly, they released those two films, Salome, the Rita Hayworth film, and this film, Serpent of the Nile, with Rhonda Fleming, about 6 weeks apart in theaters. And that kind of takes me back, because there were some people who went to the theater every week, and if your local theater ran Columbia Films, wouldn't some of the sets and the clothing look like a movie that you saw a few weeks back, but populated with different actors? I think they perhaps should have paced these two movies out maybe a little bit better. And like I said, they really missed some opportunities here. But as I said, the Technicolor looks great. Rhonda Fleming was known as a few other actresses were, quite honestly, but she was known as the queen of Technicolor. So it is good to see her. But even if you don't get to see her the way she is supposed to look, or the way you expect her, I guess the way you expect her to look. And instead has this black Betty Page wig on. And
she was ahead of
her
time, Brian, I tell you. She was ahead of her time.
Well, could be. I've read quite a bit about her, and I really like Rhonda Fleming. And I'm a big noir fan. I like crime dramas, and she's really good in them. Some of her 40s film noir the efforts are really good. She's in a movie with John Payne and Arlene Dahl called Slightly Scarlet, which is a color film, but it is noirish. It's not necessarily black and white. And I really like that film because there's a certain tension in the movie that really comes across, and I think everybody does a good job in it too, especially Rhonda Fleming. But in this one, like I said, I think she's just paying the bills. She doesn't have a great emotional connection with the role. And perhaps she saw this and thought, hey, this really isn't for me. But you're in a contract. And back then, if you tried to break a contract, you went on suspension. And
yeah.
it could really torpedo your career if you didn't play it right. And if you didn't have the talent to back up your threats.
Yeah, the studio systems as they evolved were sometimes nightmarish, and other times they were stairways to heaven in terms of opportunity.
Well, and a lot of it was luck, too, and what the individual actor put into it. They could only do so much for you in terms of charm school, and acting classes and diction and such, but some of it's got to be up to that person. And there again, too, probably cynical too, I suppose. But I do think that there are people in this life who are just luckier than others. Quite honestly, I don't know. Maybe you'll disagree with me on that, but I do think there are people who live more charmed lives than others.
I see that as well. There are very many people who live charmed lives, and other people who could be said to live cursed lives. And I think that's part of the human story.
Yeah, I suppose so. I guess nobody ever said it was going to be fair and equal, even though we should strive to make it fair and equal. Maybe we haven't done enough, and maybe that's why life's so tough for some people and not for others.
Now, I know that you're a teacher, and this is going to seem like a very strange mm-hmm. Question, but I'm assuming you like to read.
I do. A lot of it depends on the material, of course. I mean, reading textbooks is kind of, but other than that, if it's something that I want to read, if it is something, you know, like cinema history or something like that, oh, yeah. Yeah, I love to read.
Okay, fantastic. Because what I would like to do is I'd like to start adding to Sword and Sandal Cinema books and comics and magazines, anything that has to do with the Sword and Sandal cinema genre or the Peplum genre, the Hercules movie genre, or whatever you'd like to call what we're fixated on. So if you have any favorite books on the genre or one of the actors or one of the films, you know, that would be welcome as a review as well.
I was going to say, you know, 20 years ago, there really was so little in terms of, you know, written information on these actors. And since then, there's just been an explosion.
Yes.
You can almost find a biography on practically anybody in film that you can think of, which is great. I do have a chance from time to time to read, you know, some of the more esoteric stuff as well. So certainly I wouldn't mind. As a matter of fact, I think I have a couple of books upstairs that would fit that right in with that genre. I have one on Peplum films that I'm only about halfway through so far, but it's really good. And I have another one on Eurospy, which is, you know, I'm a big Eurospy fan. More of a psychotronic guide, you know, to Eurospy films, but it's really handy.
So, okay, we'll slowly start incorporating that new dimension and adding to the range of things that we cover and talk about on the show. And today we switched the schedule, as you know, and you are from 9 to 9:30. Ron isn't here yet, so just in case you forgot or got confused about the time, if you could stay a little while longer, that would be great. We can continue the conversation. If not, that's fine. I have some reviews and a song to add. So I leave it up to you.
No, I don't mind hanging out for a few more minutes. That's fine.
Okay, great. Fantastic.
Okay.
Also, another thing I started doing with the Theurgist first, and I'm doing it this week, is Know Your Theurgist. And I'm going to start something, Know Your Sword and Sandal Cinema Champion, which ties into the Champion Awards that we were giving for Art in a Year in the Facebook group. So
yes,
you're the first person I'd like to invite to that. And basically, we'll cover things we've covered over years, but we'll combine them in one place where we talk about you and what inspired you and what keeps you going and about your website and like a guided tour of your website. And this way, just for folks who miss the older shows and who want to get to know you a little bit better.
Well, I love that idea. Sure, I'd be happy to. And since I've made two really deep passes through my website in the last couple of years, and I'm really happy with it at the moment, except for the index page I still hate, but the individual actor pages I like how that they've you know, landed despite some of the really awkward ad placement, which I don't care for at all. I don't seem to have a whole lot of control over that. They just pop up wherever they want to pop up.
And your site looks wonderful. And again, it still has a retro feel. It's different than it was when I first discovered it over a quarter of a century ago. But it's still very retro in feel, and you've done nothing but improve it and polish it and add to it in all the years I've known you. And it's a very worthy shrine for the genre, and everyone I've talked to that is aware of it is impressed by it.
Well, that's terrific to hear. I really appreciate that. I've enjoyed building it, too, over the last 26 years. Some people might call it an obsession. I don't know. But one of the things that I've really appreciated about the website itself is that I have to keep watching films. And in doing research, I'll always stumble upon something. No matter how many movies you think you've watched, you really haven't, because there's so many more. And then trying to track them down, which is not as difficult as it, you know, was 25 or 30 years ago, certainly. As a matter of fact, with Serpent of the Nile, we did not have a copy of it. I went through our burned copies and stuff that Greg used to burn, and I went through our purchased copies, and we do not have a copy of Serpent of the Nile. The only copy that we have is on our DVR. And like I said, if you do have Turner Classic Movies and can record, or if you have them on one of the apps, and I think there is an app that has Turner on it now. Watch Serpent of the Nile when it comes back on. It's not a terrible film by any means. It is kind of campy in spots, and it is shot really well. And if for no other reason than just a historical standpoint or a viewpoint, I think it's worth watching. And it's not that long. I think it's only about 81 minutes, so it's not going to take up your whole day.
So I will give it a watch, but I won't rush to give it a watch or try to find the copy. Ron has entered the queue. Brian,
okay.
You're awesome. Thank you so very much, and I'm looking forward to the special episodes. We'll try to do them by the next month and a half for both of them.
Oh, that sounds great. I look forward to doing it.
Okay, be well, my friend, and thank you.
Okay. Have a good evening, Hercules.
You too. And we continue now with Ron Carson and Ron Carson's Coliseum, and we'll be looking at Atlas in the Land of the Cyclops. Which is at this point very visible in my bookshelf of Sword and Sandal movies. Greetings, Ron. How are you?
Good evening, Sadova. How are you?
Doing good. I learned about a new Sword and Sandal movie that I wasn't aware of. It's not something I'll be questing for, rushing out to get, but it's something I will definitely watch at least once. And it's set in ancient Egypt, and it sounded pretty interesting, and I'm surprised I never heard of it before.
Well, I'm probably wondering if you have it in your collection or not.
If I do, it's in one of those 50 packs of movies that are genre-related, so it might be one of those movies, but I don't know. I will look for it. It seems to be an obscure movie. Brian didn't even have one in his collection, and it's like you with the movie with Siracusa. You had to quest far and wide to find a copy of that.
Yes, I have a copy of it, but it's in a Region 2 DVD, so I'm not able to play it here. I'm an American player, so. But the Peplum film that has Tina Louise along with Rosano Brazzi as her co-star, where she plays four different roles, had to be a must in my collection, even though I'm not able to play it. You know, I still have it in my possession here.
So tell me what made you choose the Atlas movie.
Well, I think the last time we were speaking, we were discussing the Cyclops.
Yes.
When I came over down to New Jersey. So I said to myself, why not? I wanted to get one of those films that pretty much emphasized that character, which was very, very instrumental in, sword and sandal magic here. And, this is a movie that was, based in Italy, and it was pronounced Masiste nella terra dei ciclopi. I hope I said it right.
Well, it's probably close enough.
The movie was released overseas in 1961 and finally came into the American scene a couple of months later as the main character is Queen Capice, who is pretty much focused on being a slave by the powers of darkness until the last descendant of Ulysses is put to death because the Cyclops needs something to satisfy his appetite.
Yes, you know the story from the Odyssey where Polyphemus, who was the son of Poseidon, was blinded by Odysseus or Ulysses, as he's called sometimes.
That is correct.
So I'm sure he's carrying the grudge over from that time.
Well, it also stars a very popular sword and sandal actor from America, Gordon Mitchell, who portrays the role of Masist. And he pretty much is the center of the characters in more ways than one over here. Queen Capice is played by a lady named Chelo Alonso. And I want to make a correction. The movie didn't get released into the United States until 2 years later, in April of 1963. And there was more footage added to this particular picture because the Italian version only came in 94 minutes, and this one is 100, the American version, so to speak. It also focuses on a battle where a descendant of Ulysses is killed and his wife is enslaved, as I'm trying to get some sentences worthwhile over here. And it is showing right now at the Coliseum. It's a little chilly night. It's not bad out there, but we do provide the free popcorn and hot chocolate to the audience. It's always a good thing, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm.
If you're wondering who played the Cyclops, he's another Italian actor, Aldo Pedinotti, had that coveted role of being the one-eyed monster. So, because of the fact that we actually did speak about this subject last time I saw you when I came downstate, I just said to myself, let's do a feature film on this particular character. And it pretty much did very well overseas and across the pond too here. So, but believe it or not, the English version is dubbed with the exception of any lines that Gordon Mitchell says, because, you know, Gordon Mitchell is pretty much a very, very big established character in the world of Peplin movies. So I'm pretty sure you've heard of him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it pretty much focuses on the fact that, you know, Masist is to save Queen Capice because she doesn't want her to be a slave by the powers of darkness. And the bottom line is that the Cyclops is itching for some, you know, appetizing fare, so to speak.
Yes.
But
they did eat people, the Cyclopses, according to the mythology we have of them.
That is correct. That is correct.
Leave us have Cyclopses.
And Oreste Biancoli not only wrote this movie, but he also was very, very instrumental in the screenplay of it also. And the director was Antonio Leon Viola, who also was pretty popular in cranking out sword and sandal movies out in Europe. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if my uncle Achilles, who had the movie theater in Athens, was showing all these Peplum sword and sandal films.
Probably.
Because it was very, very well received in our native Greece, too. So that's what it comes down to. It's a genre of entertainment that's not only pretty much what you call limited to the United States. I mean, this peplum craze is worldwide in more ways than one, you know?
Uh-huh.
So there are two producers in this movie, Luigi Carpentieri and Ermanno Donati. And you know, let me just give you the rest of this cast over here. Queen Penelope, I wonder if that's kind of a throwback on Penelope. You know what I mean? Penelope?
Yes. Probably.
She was played by Vera Salenti. Dante DiPaolo was Ifito. Aldo Bufilandi was Cerone. Giotto Tempestini, Aronio. Raffaella Cara as Eber. Paul Winter as Mumba, and Massimo Righi was Ethros, which has a little bit of a Greek spin to it, so to speak.
Yes. Yes, it does.
So, you know, this is pretty much a movie that pits the Cyclops against an army of people to stop him from his evil doings. So, and the bottom line is that, you know, the centerpiece of the movie is a raid on the village by the Queen Capys's soldiers, as the descendant of Ulysses was killed and his wife was enslaved. And there's an infant son that is taken away, and Marciste is in quest of getting him back in this particular picture also. So, you know, the reception of this movie, when you believe Atlas has been added later instead of during the movie, it was called War Against the Cyclops to start. I don't know why they changed it and put Atlas in there as well, but that pretty much...
I could answer that.
All right,
for
go
you.
Ahead. Chime in if you can.
Basically, when they remarketed the movies, they would pick heroes that resonated with the people. So if the people loved Hercules, it became a Hercules movie. If they loved Samson, it became a Samson movie. If they loved Machista, mm-hmm. it became a Machista movie. If they loved Atlas, it became an Atlas movie. Whatever was popular, Taurus, Ursus. So they changed the name of the heroes. This happens a lot with the Hercules movies, where a lot of them were Machista movies, and he's just Hercules. You even have the Mighty Sons of Hercules. What do you call it? The son of Hercules was Hercules himself. So they didn't translate very consistently, but the name of the hero depended on where the movie was being shown.
Yeah, I'm just wondering why they kind of omitted the character of Hercules in this particular picture. I mean, do you have any say on that?
No, just maybe their marketing department felt that Atlas would be more popular in that movie.
Oh, okay. So they didn't want to really focus on the attention for Hercules, but they wanted to pretty much give a spotlight on Atlas and the Land of the Cyclops. So that's basically
it was very arbitrary, and it had more to do with marketing. Like, remember the show The Mighty Sons of Hercules we used to watch?
Oh, yes. We used to watch that, I remember, when we were younger.
Those films were totally unrelated to each other, except through marketing. They were unrelated films that were given a common, like, brand, The Mighty Sons of Hercules. And they were either real sons of Hercules or in spirit sons of Hercules. And they made their dreams into history and fought the bad guys and toppled the tyrants and things like that. But that was a marketing gimmick. The movies actually had nothing to do with each other or with the common theme in most cases. So it's the same type of thing. A lot of movies that I like and I've seen as Hercules movies, they're also Machista movies in Italian. Some of the Sons of Hercules movies are Ursus movies. So there was a great book written about this called Peplum Stud or Retro Stud.
Yes.
That's the name of the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, people are wondering if they can actually purchase this and put it in their collection. The answer is no.
Really?
It is available for free viewing, and you have to go to the Internet Archives to download the movie and watch all 100 minutes of it. So very difficult to find on Amazon or any other platform where you want to order a DVD or a VHS of this picture. But I'm sure at some point, Savitha, you do have this movie in your collection.
I do have it. I do have this movie. I have several copies of the movie in different collections. But yes, the movie I think was available once upon a time at Alpha Video, but I don't know if Alpha is producing videos or those videos. Limnos, where we come from, aside from being the island of the Amazons and the island where Hercules revealed his Olympian divinity to people during the Trojan War, was also where Hephaestus had his forge. There's the Hephaestia. The area that's sacred to Hephaestus. And then there's an extinct volcano where Hephaestus had his workshop. and he had golden robot women helping him, and he also had three Cyclopses, the original three Cyclopses from Day of the Primordials, who Zeus freed from the Tartarus pits, and they worked for him by creating his thunderbolts, and that was done on Eumus as well. So we come from a land of Cyclopses.
Oh, I know, and the actual location is west of where we were from Mudra, right near Castro, in Midas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Up there in the mountains. That's where Hephaestus was put into exile, if you remember, in Limnos.
He fell in the waters, and he was raised by the mer people, the underwater people who were Poseidons, and that's where he learned with the volcanic energies to create jewelry and weapons and incredible devices. So they got the attention of the Olympians, and then they allowed him back onto Olympus.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's a very hard to find movie to put into your collection these days. And if you've got a couple of copies, if you have a spare one, I would love to take a gander at that.
If I have a spare copy, it's yours. Unless it's in a collection, then I can't break up the collection. But
I understand. I understand.
I will look for it.
Excellent. Excellent. Let me just give more credit to other people who were involved in the film. The cinematography was by Riccardo Palottini. It was edited by Mario Serandre, and Carlo Innocence provided the music. And it was from a independent company known as Panda. I don't know if you remember any Sword and Sandal films coming out from the Panda production company.
Not necessarily.
Well, this is one of them over here. And I'm looking at the lobby card on my notes over here, and it's a very interesting motley group of pictures that you would, you know, pretty much encompass during the film. Now, let me tell you something. The audience here at the Coliseum is enamored by this picture because it's kind of like one of those lost movies that you haven't, you know, seen or heard from in quite a while. So.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line is that it's good to revisit some of these forgotten Peplum films because they still do exist. And my mission is to bring to my audience in the Coliseum a series of movies that, you know, they probably remember from way back when, but then they forgot about them. And this is probably a memory jogger in itself for sure.
It certainly is. If I wasn't so fixated on Lemnian lore, it would be a very obscure movie to me. But because the Cyclopses play a part in our history, our personal history, the tales are forever on my mind. But for most other people, this would be one of the more obscure films, especially since it may not be available unless you go to the archives.
Yep. And that's where you have to go probably to actually view this picture, in the archives. So, but give it time. Maybe Amazon or one of these other platforms that sells VHSs and DVDs or Blu-rays will manage to put it out for circulation, you know?
Uh-huh.
And that would be a good thing if you ask me.
Yeah, it definitely would be a good thing. And if people ask for it, somebody's going to print it. Or when they settle on a new format to replace the Blu-ray totally, we have 4K, we have several other formats emerging. When one of them replaces all of them, which has happened since the days of VHS and before, when Beta was a reality. DVDs.
Do you remember owning a Betamax at some point in your life, Kazava?
No, I never owned a Betamax.
Yeah, because they were sky-high expensive when they came out in the 80s. I think the Betamax came out the same year your son was born, in 85.
Yes, yes. And I remember I saved $500 to get a VHS machine and a Conan the Barbarian VHS tape. It was $80, the Conan tape alone.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but if you can get your hands on seeing Atlas in the Land of Cyclops, You have my total recommendation. You know, Gordon Mitchell, as you know, is a very, very established sword and sandal actor, and I pretty much reviewed a lot of stuff that he's done before as well. So
right.
And it's pretty much, he's the only, just like Raymond Burr in Godzilla, he was the only character that spoke bona fide English. Gordon Mitchell is the same way in this particular picture also. So.
Now, do you have more to share about the movie, or if not, I can share?
No, I do believe we're done. Your quest here from yours truly is, if you really want to own a copy of this picture, good luck. But it is available on Internet Archives to watch it, so I would suggest you tap in and check it out. It's only 100 minutes of your time, an hour and 40 minutes, so you would be pretty interested to see this type of picture. You know, which kind of like narrows it down to making the Cyclops its star. So I definitely wanted to get one of those particular films in there that kind of spotlighted the Cyclops' role in this sword and sandal movie making.
And you did a great job, and I thank you for it. And I'll
well,
share...
you're very welcome. I mean, I'm like I said, I'm very, very big into this peplum, you know, material because of the fact that you and I grew up with it. We watched it in theaters. We watched it on Channel 9 on TV and the Million Dollar Movie all the time. So, as a matter of fact, you know, Gordon Mitchell is very, very established actor in more
yes.
ways than one. So. And I'm sure you have other projects with him, you know, on your collection for sure. Because I remember I reviewed another movie of Gordon Mitchell, and he was a bodybuilder too. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes, he was. Yes, and I believe he was a friend of Keith Reeves as well.
I'm sorry?
I believe he was a friend of Steve Reeves's as well.
Oh, yes, yes, the original Hercules, yes.
Yes.
Absolutely, your role model, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, Hercules movies go back to 1910. There was a cartoon on Hercules. It took me decades to find it, but I finally found a copy of it. And,
oh, you do have a copy of it? Okay.
Yes, and then there were a couple of Hercules-type characters in movies, and there was one movie, I forget the title right now, with Hercules in it. I believe it was Hercules and the Amazons. Or that was the subject, if not the title. And then it was Steve Reeves that ushered in the age of the Hercules movie or the Sword and Sandal movie or the Peplum movie.
Sure. Well, let me kind of give you one more synopsis of what films Gordon Mitchell co-starred in during his career, including Sinbad, Seven Slaves Against the World, Treasures of the Petrified Forest. I don't know if that's a remake of the Humphrey Bogart film. He had did some spaghetti westerns as well, and also in a Fellini film, Fellini Satyricon. So he was a very, very established actor, and, you know, like I said, I think he did have a connection with Steve Reeves because of the bodybuilding thing, because he was pretty much influenced to go through that path when the original Hercules movie came out. So there you have it. Gordon Mitchell, born Charles Allen Pendleton. That was his real name.
Well, thank you so very much. I enjoyed your presentation today. I will not have time to do my review, but I will play the song that I had set aside. This one's called Mighty Elohim. And Greece, Italy, the biblical lands, they all surround the Mediterranean and are part of Mediterranean culture, the Egyptians. So there was a lot of borrowing back and forth. And the information of the ancients keeps repeating itself time and again. And what we have in the modern times, started over a century ago, is the new theosophy. Blavatsky, Bordosky, post Dark Age, Renaissance theosophy, and then other people picked up the baton and ran with it and gave us the new theosophy. And in the new theosophy, Hercules and Athena and Apollo and many of the rest are Elohim. And someone I know wrote a song about it, and the song won an award. This is an earlier version of the song, so we'll share that as we close today. And thank you, Xavier.
All right, well, Xavier, it was a joy to be back after missing last month. I was glad to, take one of those movies that we haven't heard about in a long time, but it's not forgotten. So hopefully people can actually go online and check out the finished product of this terrific movie that pretty much has the Cyclops in his starring role over here. So I will catch you again next month. I'll talk to you soon.
Be well and success in all your adventures. And tatapume. And now, mighty Elohim.
All right, Kalinista, Xadafe, I love you.
I love you too. Take care, Kalinista.
Good night.
Good night.
This is the spirit.